So we have put together speakers from different jurisdictions. We are going to travel around the two Americas talking about child adoption this afternoon. We will start with Jonathan from South Carolina. We will continue with Alfonso in Mexico. Then we will move to Colombia with Andres, continue in Uruguay with Bernardo, and we will conclude with Victoria. So let me introduce you the speakers. They will be talking to us for 7 minutes, 7 to 8 minutes, and you can put your questions in the questions and answer in the tool, and we will try to have some time to answer your questions. Those questions that we cannot answer today, I will make sure that the speakers can deal with them, and we will send them to you. So let's start with Jonathan. Let me introduce you very briefly, Jonathan. Jonathan is from South Carolina. He's a fellow of the International Academy and also a fellow of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. Jonathan has a wide state practice in South Carolina. He specializes in international family law and in Hague cases. He has experience as a practitioner, as a representing applicants and defendants. He has cases with Brazil, Bermuda, Venezuela, England, Ireland, France. And I was quite touched when I heard that he was inspired by Marie Hutchinson to become an international family lawyer and to do Hague work when he met her and organized with her a CLE conference. Jonathan loves traveling. He's been around Europe and as far as New Zealand. And he's currently training to do the New York Marathon. He will be doing this in the memory of his mother. So Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us today. Jonathan is going to talk about undertakings, mirror orders, enforcement, practical arrangements, because we want to highlight what is different in Hague cases in these jurisdictions. So thank you, Jonathan.
Good morning. Thank you, Carolina. Welcome from South Carolina. So I'm going to touch briefly on the convention. The 1988 Hague Convention on the Civil Aspects of International Child Abduction is a treaty that is with the U.S. and I think around 100 countries now, maybe, or a little bit more. For us, it's the substantive and fundamental, it's the substantive law and contains the fundamental causes of action for a Hague return case. We have a statute that enacts the treaty in the United States, which is the International Child Abduction Return Act, which is ICARA. It's in the federal statutes. And that federal statute, interestingly enough, gives us the ability to either file a case in federal court, which would be our district courts, or in state court. So you can have a return case filed in a district court, which is my preference because I believe it's a lot faster, or in the family court of your jurisdiction. So in South Carolina, it could be filed in the state court here, which normally deals with family court. Our expected time frame in dealing with these cases as set forth in the convention is about 6 weeks. Now, I find when I file the cases in federal court, it's about 2 to 2.5 months to get the case resolved. There are instances where the cases take longer. An instance, I'll talk about Galan versus Saeta, which is a big case right now in the United States, which the trial court case was not very long, but it's been on appeal for the last 3 or so years. And I had a case one time where it was removed from state court to federal court, which just caused the procedure to last longer than the 6 weeks. We're going to talk today about the defense of 13B, the grave risk defense, which I find is the defense that I deal with most often. The other defense I would deal with most often is basically that the party doesn't have the rights that they say that they do. They don't have the rights of custody, the rights of visitation. But more often than not, it's grave risk. And more often than not, it is an allegation of domestic abuse or spousal abuse or violence between the parents, not necessarily directed towards the child, which will tie in nicely to the Saeta versus Golan case, which is what a trial level right now on appeal. It's Golan versus Saeta. That defense, for us, you've got to have a clear and convincing demonstration of evidence that there's a grave risk of harm to return the child. So a lot of times people will argue that because the parents have an abusive relationship with each other, the argument would be that the child doesn't need to go back to the country of habitual residence because it's going to be exposed to that violence continually. the courts, in effort to deal with that, take some measures, which is kind of the crux of that case I keep mentioning, the Golan versus Saida, which are sometimes called undertakings or ameliorative measures. And these are measures where the court suggests certain things be promised by either party to be done upon the return of the child, right? For instance, you would have that they pay for the return, that they cover some legal fees to have a case, a custody case enacted in the form in the habitual residence. These are essentially, when they're ameliorative measures, they're essentially promises. Basically, there's not a real good mechanism for enforcement unless the court deals with the Hague Convention network of judges and tries to find a way to make sure that these measures are enforceable in the country of habitual residence. I have a preference of using what are sometimes called mere orders or safe harbor orders. It's a little bit clearer to me, and particularly if I'm prosecuting the case and having the child returned, I want to, in instances where the client I'm representing may not have a prior order of visitation or custody, I want to go ahead and begin that process so when the child is returned to the country of habitual residence, there's not a gap or a lag, and there are no gamesmanships between the left-behind parent and the parent who removed the child from jurisdiction. I also find that in doing those orders, it requires me to find a lawyer in the country of habitual residence to make sure that whatever we're agreeing to or asking the court to order is enforceable. And that, again, gives the client the ability to have feet on the ground running. In fact, I've reached out to Carolina before in the case that we had in England, Carolina and Anne-Marie, to make sure that what we wanted to do was okay in England, so that a mere order could be entered there. So when the child was returned, or in that case, when the children were returned, everybody knew what to expect. There are some limitations with using those mere orders or safe harbor orders. One of the limitations to consider is the amount of time it may take, right? Things in the U.S. may take a lot less time to get done than it may take in the country of habitual residence. So that's something to be cognizant of, because you don't want to give the parent who removed the child the ability to kind of kick the can down the road, as they say, just to lollygag and take more time and prevent the return. The other is, you may have some technical difficulties in getting an order done. For instance, if there's no existing custody case, you may have to have a case instituted in the country of habitual residence, or there just may be some procedural difficulties in getting those things done. So I know that Carolina wanted me to talk about the case that's now before the Supreme Court of the United States, which is Golan versus Saida. And I know that one of the lawyers involved in the case is attending the webinar, so I'm fairly certain he will correct me if I get anything wrong. But this case was a return action filed by Mr. Saida, who is an Italian citizen, against Ms. Golan, who is an American citizen. Ms. Golan had removed the child from Italy to the United States, specifically to New York. And Mr. Saida hired an attorney and they filed a return action in, I think, the summer of 2018. The court ultimately made a decision around March of 2019 that the child be returned to Italy. And the court made this decision despite making a finding of grave risk of harm. Now, the grave risk of harm that the court found in this case was kind of what I find to be the prototypical allegation, is that there was a volatile relationship between the parents. The child was not the target of any violence or volatility. But the parents just, they couldn't get along. There was this amount of abuse in that relationship that trickled down to the child, and that the child was exposed to it. In making the order of return and understanding that there was this grave risk finding, the court asked the parties to undertake these certain ameliorative measures to ensure that the violence wouldn't perpetuate once the child was returned. Some of the things that the court ordered were that Mr. Saida would provide housing and financial support for Ms. Golan and the child when they returned. Mr. Saida would stay away from the child and Ms. Golan until the Italian court to deal with kind of the issues of abuse or custody. Mr. Assaya to dismiss any criminal charges against Ms. Galan that were pending in Italy, that Mr. Assaya to begin attending cognitive therapy. So these steps or measures taken to kind of ameliorate the rift between the parties, the abusive relationship between the parties. Ms. Galan appealed to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York, and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals found that it was appropriate for the order to be returned subject to these ameliorative measures, but they remanded it back to the district court to determine whether or not the measures that the court asked be taken were in fact enforceable or feasible in Italy. The district court judge used the Hague Convention network of judges, reached out to a judge in Italy, and there was discussions about things that could be done and that were enforceable and that were feasible in Italy to deal with diminishing the violence. And she issued the district court judge issued a new order with different ameliorative measures, but in the same vein. Ms. Galan appealed that order, which the Second Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed. And then Ms. Galan filed a writ of certiorari in the Supreme Court of the United States, which is where the action sits now. Briefs have been filed by both parties. There are two amici briefs that have been filed. And the court has sent the matter to the Solicitor General of the United States to have it give its opinion on what the United States believes its opinion is on this issue. The issue at crux is this: whether or not the courts, after having a finding of grave risk of harm or as part of determining grave risk, are they required to examine these ameliorative measures? It's my understanding from reading all the briefs and kind of dealing with this issue that there is no rule in the United States that either requires or prevents a court from using these ameliorative measures. It's a matter of discretion with the court. And so that's what the Supreme Court, I guess, is waiting on an opinion from Solicitor General to deal with. It's kind of like when we had the Manaski versus Taglieri case a couple of years ago. That case dealt with a split in the test we use to determine what habitual residence is. So this is kind of in the same vein. So hopefully we'll have an idea of whether or not these measures are mandatory or it's proper to use in cases of finding grave risk.
Fantastic, Jonathan. As you know, we all, the Hague community, is quite interested to know what the Supreme Court will be dealing with. This very significant, whatever they say. So thank you so much. I know it's very important topics like mirror orders that we should dedicate more time, but let's deal with this in the next conference that we will organize for soon. Thank you so much, and good luck with that marathon.
Thank you.
And now we are going to move to Mexico. We have Alfonso Sepúlveda with us. Alfonso has his office in Mexico City. He does cross-border cases. He as an expert in Mexican law in different foreign courts, including the courts in England and Wales. He also does commercial arbitration. And Alfonso is a fellow of the International Academy of Family Lawyers, and he has also been very instrumental on expanding the academy in Mexico. He organized in 2019 a symposium on Hague matters. It was in May 2019 where he hosted us. It was a fantastic experience. He managed to get together a lot of judicial representatives, central authorities, and lawyers who have an interest in Hague matters, and it was a really constructive event in Mexico. So Alfonso is going to talk to us about Hague matters in Mexico, and in particular about the amparo. We all want to know or to understand what is the Mexican amparo. So thank you, Alfonso, for being with us today.
No, thank you, Carolina, for the invitation. Can you hear me well?
Yeah, very well. Thank you.
Okay. So yes, as you indicate, Mexico has conducted very important efforts to make this convention work. Of course, this 1980 convention has been applied in Mexico for almost 30 years now, and the world has changed since 30 years ago, a lot, quite a lot. I know I'm aware that Mexico sometimes has been criticized or hardly judged for being non-compliant with the Hague Convention. But I think the reason underlying that situation or that objection that is made to Mexico is that it took a while for the Mexican court system to understand how to best apply the Hague Convention. Unfortunately, we don't have, and I know efforts have been conducted worldwide to have a model law, you know, on how to deal with hate cases of child abduction. You know? As you indicated, Carolina, we had this symposium, and it's one of the many symposiums that have been taking place in throughout Mexico for the last 30 years, trying to reunite judges, central authorities, and experts or people that practice family law to see how to best apply this international convention, how to balance this convention with due process requirements, with formalities. As we all know, some countries are more formalistic than others. Seems to me that Latin American countries tend to be more formalistic than non-Latin American countries, like the US, for instance. And because we're very formalistic, it takes longer period of time to have a case go through the whole judicial review process. We do have, for instance, in hate cases, including, we have to go before the trial court, then we go before an appellate court in some jurisdictions, not in all jurisdictions. But all of these cases end up being before the highest Mexican courts, which are called known as the Amparo Courts. Amparo Court being a court that handles constitutional appeals. Before I go to the Amparo proceeding, I would like to state up something. We just heard the previous panel indicate that relocation proceedings take a while in their own countries, in their countries. And same is true in Mexico. Relocation proceedings can take a long time. And I don't think efforts have been conducted to instruct countries how to deal with relocation cases or relocation requests, which of course invites people to try to take justice into their own hands and abduct children when they see and realize that going through the proper channel, which is the court system, if you don't get the consent of the other parent, it can take a while. And of course, one of the reasons why this takes a while is because the parent reluctant to accept a relocation will be challenging every single order that he can or she can challenge, which will delay the process. We had a case in the past in which I suggested our client to go through the judicial process, which is ask for permission. And you only ask for permission before the court, because the other parent was not willing to give that permission for a relocation, of course. And the case took about 3 years, and it was not decided by the court. The mother ended up being able to take the child back to the US. And this was a US-Mexican case, no? So I think it would be useful for countries to try to instruct, show and capacitate judges and attorneys and experts on how to handle relocation cases in a more swift manner. Otherwise, we're going to be facing more abduction cases. Now, so yes, as Carolina was mentioning, we did have, for instance, this seminar before the Mexican judiciary, and it helped a lot to see how the Mexican courts are conducting a very important efforts to have cases solved as swift as possible. Of course, we do have due process rules that we need to follow, which sometimes delay the proceedings. But now, after 30 years of having applied this convention, I can tell you that there are sufficient binding precedents that close doors on the imagination of attorneys who are willing to try to avoid a return of a child that has been wrongfully retained or wrongfully removed from the country of their habitual residence. So we now have fortunately, sufficient precedents that the Mexican binding precedents that the Mexican trial courts and appellate courts need to apply when handling hate cases, which makes them faster and more swift in the handling of these cases. International relations between people and couple are growing. You all are very aware of this situation. And because these relations are growing, people from one country get together with people from another country, and then they have children in common. And when that relationship splits up, then it's a problem how to deal with the child born from that relationship. On many occasions, internet relationship generated by the internet. So cases have been growing. We are, as one of the results of these seminars that have been conducted in the past, we're trying to instruct not only the judges, but also the attorneys handling the cases on how to understand the Hague Convention properly. As I was saying, Mexico sometimes, more in the past than nowadays, but in the past, Mexico used to be considered a country non-compliant with the Hague case or the Hague Convention, because it took a while for cases to be decided because of this amparo proceeding. Amparo proceeding is basically a constitutional appeal that you can file against a ruling of an authority, of a court, for instance, in Hague cases, in which you can challenge that such order, for instance, a restitution order, is in violation of constitutional rights of either the children or of the parent who retained the child unlawfully, or the parent that removed the child from the country of habitual residence. And the thing with this amparo proceeding, which is not a bad proceeding at all, because many violations committed by state courts are solved, are repaired by this amparo proceeding. So we're not sad of having this amparo proceeding in place. We're very glad that we do have this amparo proceeding in place. But sometimes, as I said, it takes a while for these proceedings to be decided. No? But I guess the most important thing to say in regards to Mexico is that best efforts have been conducted. We now have a sufficient binding precedents. Mexico can no longer be considered a country non-compliant with the Hague because we do solve the cases. Sometimes it takes a while. And the problem sometimes is that the Mexican attorneys are not knowledgeable of the Hague Convention, and attorneys trying to defend the client delay the cases in an apparent benefit of the party reluctant to return a child. But at the end result is that the child will be returned to the country of its origin, of its habitual residence, and that parent who abducted the child in the future will want the child to continue his cultural relationship with his family abroad, and will have a lot of trouble, no, asking a judge to authorize the children to go back to his country or her country of origin if one of the parents abducted that child in the past. So, and we've had, for instance, cases in the US or in England and Wales, as Carolina was mentioning, which the courts asked us, how can they go about getting some sort of mirror order in place in Mexico, for instance, so that a child that in the past was subject of or an object of international abduction can go back to that country. And what we've said is sometimes not even the mother or their father who abducted the child responsible really for that abduction, but it was just terrible lawyer's advice that such person received from the lawyer. So we're trying to teach the lawyers how to go about this convention and how to defend a case. No? For instance, nowadays with this COVID, now it's being argued that returning a child to its to his or her country of habitual residence can be or can present a grave risk to that children if COVID situation is bad in that country, no? So this kind of allegations are still being brought. But fortunately, as I've said, I think we have sufficient precedents in place that stop an abducting parent from getting away with, no, an abduction. I think that's going to be all I'm going to be saying for now, Carolina. We can then come back with responses for any questions that might be brought by the audience.
No. Thank you so much, Alfonso. I'm sure that I know that you are ready. You are available whenever you have any questions. Anyone have any questions about Mexico, so they can ask in the questions and answer or send you an email. It's interesting what you say about relocation. I think we cannot talk about child abduction without talking about relocation. And maybe this is a good forum to, and one of the conclusions of this conference is like to invite the Hague conference to put together again a working group to deal about relocation and child adoption. It was in 2009 when it was the Declaration of New York. So I think it's time to renew or to review that declaration and to deal with relocation and child adoption in tandem together. So it's true, Alfonso, in my experience, Mexico is improving. I think it's a specialization, as you say, is more obvious. And I believe people will correct me that you are not in the list of the State Department released on the 30th of April about non-compliance country. So I think it was Argentina and Brazil from South America, but not Mexico. But they will correct me if I am wrong. So well done, Mexico, and carry on with the good work in Hague matters. And now we move to Colombia. So Andres Gomez is with us. He's not a fellow of the International Academy or a member of IJUDEFA, but hopefully he will be part of all of us soon. Andres specializes in family law in Colombia. He was a judge's clerk for various years, but now he has his own practice. He concentrates on child protection and he likes sports. He plays tennis, football, cycling, so very healthy, sporty man here. And he's going to talk to us about what he thinks is the more particular treatment of Hague cases in Colombia. I think we will be surprised to hear the important involvement of the central authority in Colombia. I think they have a very important role in comparison with other jurisdictions. So thank you, Andres, for being with us. And please go ahead.
Carolina, thank you very much for the invitation. And thank you, everybody, for having us here. Definitely, we're going to be a part of the Academy sooner this year. And, well, I'm glad that you have Colombia invited to this seminar because it's really important to us to show the people that Colombia subscribed the Hague Convention back in 1989. And the process here moves really fast in order to the ruling from the family judge. But as I told Carolina, when we discussed about how things works here in Colombia, there's no judicial concentration here because every time somebody wants to initiate an abduction process has to do it over the central authority in the leftover parent jurisdiction. Then the central authority from that part of the world comes to Colombia through the central authority. And then the ICBF, who represents our country in these cases, analyze the first situation and they initiate a process where they establish that definitely the kids were abducted or not. Because, and taking something about what Alfonso was saying is definitely is really important for us. There's no chance to left aside the relocation situation. So what the central authority does is define if the kids were actually abducted or not, if there's a case or not. And what they do in the first instance is that they contact the person who brought the kids without the other parent permission and try to conciliate with them in order to persuade them to go back where they were. But that definitely doesn't work every time. And the ICBF most of the cases have to go and file a lawsuit against the parent who brought the kids and start a judicial process in front of the family judge. So as I told Carolina, the process is in Colombia is ruled in order of the whatever the Hague Convention determines about the all the instance that has to go through to get to the ruling. And that really gets solved really fast. We are talking here that we're having rules on the first instance for 6 months or over the first 6 months. So everything here is, you know, in order to explain you that the family judge doesn't have much time to present different evidence than the one that comes from the central authority. So basically, when a person files this process over, they have to brought all the evidence that they can, because the ICBF will be the one who will be presenting this evidence in front of the judge. And because of the terms, the judge in most of the cases won't be able to present or to request new evidence, and he will rule with whatever the ICBF is presenting. So basically, what I explained to Carolina is the most or one of the most important situations here in Colombia is what the psychological professionals that support the ICBF thinks or presents to the judge about the well-being of the kids. And that's really important. And we have a very special case here from a client from us in France who filed the request over the central authority through the embassy of France, and the ICBF initiated the process. They request everything from the mother. The mother was, you know, was here in Bogota, so it was like not most of the cases. She approved to go to the ICBF and deal with the situation and try to conciliate the first part with the parent. But in that initial part of the process, the psychologist determined that the kids were in danger because the mother was using too much violence to correct them. And as they didn't conciliate, they went to the judge for ruling. Because again, because of the terms, the judge ruled in the first instance within 6 months. And we were uncovered problems because this ruling was like in May last year. So we were afraid of what Alfonso said, that maybe the situation in France wasn't the better for the COVID situation, but we actually got wood with that one. But what the judge had, like for his most important evidence, was that the psychological assistant from the ICBF told the judge that the kids were in danger because of the excessive violence from the mother. He didn't rule in order with the evidence that showed that the mother brought the kids to Colombia with lies. They brought them here with their Colombian passport, and she used her Colombian residence to keep them here. So I think that part is really important in Colombia, because basically that will determine where the kids are going to be relocated or not. And sometimes we can get a really efficient and good ruling, but we don't know what kind of professional will be, you know, determine the situation for the kids. And that can change everything just because one or two statements that are presented and are not, you know, so realistic. And it's very subjective, but right now we got the ruling that we needed, but it was really for us. And it was like, everything right now it depends on what the psychologist will say. And that's really, really important. And you know, there's another part of the Hague Convention that was really important for us and was the one to determine, and the judge ruled for that too, that there was no possibility to discuss the custody process. So there's not going to be any ruling for the custody process, because that has to be ruled by the jurisdiction where the kids are. So Colombia doesn't rule about that, only about the abduction.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Andres. So it's quite interesting to see the central authority being the body who is collecting evidence, who is preparing the evidence for the case. It's completely different in other jurisdictions, like, for example, in England and Wales. So yeah, you say 6 months, it's very quick, but it looks to me like it's a long time for first instance. How many appeals do you have in Colombia, Andres? Andres? I think we have lost him. Andres, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I'm here, I'm here.
How many appeals do you have
in appeals. Colombia? We have two appeals, one in front of the... We have two, the one in front of the tribunal and the other one to the Supreme Court. But actually, that's not the longest part, because they take 20 days to rule.
Okay.
But yeah, the first 6 months are, you know, it's long, but for Colombian process, this is like really, really, really fast.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much, Andres, for being with us. And let's hope we see you in other activities of the Academy and IJUDEFA in the future. Thank you.
Definitely, now, you will see me.
Thank you. So now we move to Uruguay. We are going to hear from Bernardo Lagnani. Bernardo is a fellow of the International Academy. He's also a member of IJUDEFA, founded member of IJUDEFA. He specializes in family law. He works in the Central Authority in Uruguay. He will explain us his role there. He's the coordinator for judicial studies in Uruguay for family courses and specialist courses. He's the author of many, many legal articles, but an author of a manual, a book on family law and divorce law and succession law. And this book is very successful in Uruguay. It's already going through the sixth edition. So congratulations, Bernardo. And I think I think we are very privileged to hear from him, because I know that Uruguay is like the England in South America. Everyone thinks that they have the best process. They deal with this very quickly. They have judicial concentration, specialization. So he's going to tell us all about this and how also it has a lot of similarities with Colombia about the role of the central authority. Thank you, Bernardo, for being with us today.
Okay, good morning to all. I'd like to thank IJUDEFA and IAFL for the invitation to join this panel. And I will refer to the process of international child recovery and some judicial decisions concerning the exception of Article 13B of the Hague Convention. The process of international child recovery is governed by the law number 18,995 that rules this matter since the year 2012. This law has for guidance the main legal principles of the 1980 Hague Convention. The procedure has three previous stages. The first previous stage is the filing of the petition for the child's return to his country of residence before the competent court. The second previous stage, it's the verification by the court of the admissibility of the claims requirements and the competency of the claimant to bring suit. And the third previous stage is that once the claim is admitted, the court within the next 24 hours fulfills the following activities. A, the court issues an order to the return of the child to his country of residence. B, the court convenes the abducting parent to present a defense, that is, to oppose legal exceptions against the return of the child within a period of 10 days. C, the court adopts measures for the protection of the child, for example, confiscation of the passport and border closures. And D, the court assigns defenders for the minor and also for the subtractor. According to Article 15 of the Uruguayan law, the defenses or exceptions that can be raised by the subtractor defendant, which are the same of those established in Article 13 of the Hague Convention, must be made in a well-founded written statement to which all the supporting evidence of the same is attached. Once expired the time limit of 10 days for raising defenses, a hearing is convened within the next 72 hours, which has the following characteristics. First, the absence of any of the parties, nor the absence of the minor, does not prevent it from being held. Second, the court rules on the evidence offered by the parties and its decision might be appealed. Third, conciliation is attempted. Fourth, the parties and the minor will be heard. The minor, according to his or her age, maturity, and personal circumstances, may speak directly before the court or through his defendant. It should be clarified that the opinion of the minor's defendant is not mandatory for the court. And finally, the court may render the sentence at the hearing or extend the hearing for up to 24 hours for that purpose. On what concerns procedural instances, there are two instances, being the second instance, a consequence of the right to appeal. The second instance decision does not allow any further appeal against it. On what relates to Article 13 of the Hague Convention, the exceptions to the legal principle of immediate return of the subtracted child, and the most frequently argued, is established in Article 13b and Article 15b of the Uruguayan law. The terms that are used by this legal rule must be interpreted together with the evidentiary material, applying a critical and strict judgment in order to determine whether the return of the child to the country of previous residence exposes the minor to dangers that may affect his or her physical or mental health, or exposes him or her to an intolerable situation. Therefore, the danger referred to in this exception must generate a marked degree of distress which must be equal to or greater than the emotional impact that a minor normally suffers as a consequence of parental separation. In this regard, the exception can also be linked to the lack of physical, moral, or psychological suitability of the person requesting the return, as is in the case of the person who is addicted to alcohol or drugs, is an abuser, or is a physically or morally violent person. The exception can also be contemplated for external causes to the claimant, for example, the serious risks or dangers that can be found in the child's place of residence due to the family or due to the neighborhood environment of the claimant. The affectation of the physical and psychological integrity of the minor is usually evaluated by the judicial authority with the help of experts. Some judicial decisions of interest related to the exception of Article 13B are the decision of second instance of the Family Court of Appeals of second turn, dated April the 2nd of 2018, that revoked the first instance judgment and denied the return of several minors that were siblings to each other and of different ages on the basis that in connection with the Article 13B, the return may be denied if it is proven that the minors are opposed to it and they have reached an age and a degree of maturity that it is appropriate to take into account their opinions. The court also considered in this case that the demonstrated violent character of the restitution claimant exposed on emails and WhatsApp messages would entail for them the certain risk of suffering a physical or psychological danger. We also find the judgment of second instance of the Family Court of Appeals of second turn dated April the 3rd of 2018 that confirmed the return with the requesting mother, which was determined in the first instance with the condition that within a period of 60 days, it had to be proven first that judicial actions were taken to clarify the statements asserted by the minor who had alleged sexual abuse by the stepfather. Second, it had to be proved that the requested mother no longer lived with the stepfather. And finally, that any meeting between the minor and the alleged aggressor had been avoided. In this case, the court considered the minor to be a fantasy-ridden pre-adolescent on the basis of the expert opinions and her own statements. And finally, the second instance judgment of the Family Court of Appeals of first turn dated April 1st, 2019, confirmed the first instance sentence that denied the return and accepted the exception of Article 13B, since several domestic violence events between the restitution claiming and the requested had been proven. This violence had not been directed towards the girl involved, but according to the expert evaluations that were performed on her, the minor was exposed to a family context of serious risk for her normal development. I'd like to thank you for your time and have respected the 10 minutes. And also I'd like to thank your kind attention. That's all.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Bernardo. We have a few questions. So I'm going to pass to Argentina. We are going to talk with Victoria about the Argentinian process, because we don't have much time and it will be nice to deal with at least with one of the questions. Victoria is a very good friend, like most of you today. Victoria is in Argentina. Victoria was a representative of the central authority in Argentina before she moved to private practice, where she's now working in Buenos Aires. And we are very lucky to have her because she was part of the working group of the guidance for the good practice guidance for Article 13B. So she's going to start telling us about the work in progress, those 7 years of work to reach the conclusions of the Hague Conference. And she's going to talk to us about, they don't have a specialized law in Argentina about Hague cases, but she has a protocol that she's going to tell us about that is, I think, is making a big difference in Argentina, and hopefully it will be something that nationally will be mirrored. So thank you, Victoria, for being with us today.
Thank you, Carolina. Happy to be here and to be part of this panel. As you mentioned, I had the pleasure of participating in one of the meetings held at The Hague by the working group that was commissioned by the Permanent Bureau to draft the Guide to Good Practice on the interpretation of Article 13B. Needless to say, this exception has proven through the years to be the most commonly raised defense in Hague proceedings. And I think the material the guide offers is of great practical value for courts, for attorneys, for central authorities who are faced with a grave risk assertion. The guide was published in March 2020, both in English and French, and has recently been translated into Spanish, partly thanks to Aijudefa's contribution. It was drafted by experts from many countries, and its main objective is to promote the proper and consistent application of the grave risk exception in accordance with the term and purpose of the 1980 Convention. The guide is intended to provide orientation. It is purely advisory in nature. It is not a binding instrument. And although it contains references to jurisprudence and comparative law, it is only to provide examples of how courts over the world have approached these assertions. The guide starts off by underlining the general principle of the convention, which is that the wrongful removal or retention is harmful to the child's welfare, and that it is in the child's best interest to return to the state of habitual residence. The fact that a court is not bound to order the return of the child based on this exception is one of the limited exceptions provided by the convention to the return mandate. So it is important that this exception to the rule be applied restrictively so as not to infringe the spirit of the convention. Argentina Supreme Court of Justice has many times referred to the restrictive nature of the exceptions in its rulings and has rejected 13B allegations, which did not amount to an intolerable situation. Another important issue highlighted by the guide is that allegations of grave risk should be promptly examined. The duty to act expeditiously does not mean that the court should neglect the proper evaluation of the exception. It does require, however, that the court only gather information or evidence that is sufficiently relevant and highly focused on the 13B exception. Each court's determination as to application of the exception is to be based on the particular circumstances of the case and should neither deal with issues of custody, as we well know, nor make a full best interest assessment of the child. Also, the exception requires a look into the future at the circumstances where the child would be placed if returned. So broad or general assertions to grave risk upon return are not sufficient. And in Argentina, this has been expressly addressed in case law from our Supreme Court of Justice. In our experience within the scope of Article 13B, many domestic violence allegations are raised, yet domestic violence per se does not necessarily amount to grave risk. The specific focus of the grave risk analysis in these cases should be whether the domestic violence will impact the child upon his or her return and whether such effect meets the high threshold of the grave risk exception. Argentina Supreme Court has ruled, for example, that an intolerable situation does not necessarily point to a situation of extreme danger in the state of habitual residence, but rather seeks to determine whether the return would place the child in psychological harm to a degree of disturbance much higher than the emotional impact which normally comes from a child either having to move back to the state of habitual residence or being separated from one of the parents. Many assertions are also made with regards to economic, educational, housing, or health concerns related to the child, but the court should not embark on a comparison between the living conditions of one or the other parent or of one of each state. This will be relevant, of course, in a subsequent custody case, but not in an Article 13B analysis. And even when the court determines that there is sufficient evidence demonstrating potential harm, it must consider whether effective measures are available to protect the child and eventually the taking parent in the state of habitual residence. As Jonathan has already very clearly explained, these protective measures should only be put in place where strictly necessary. They are not to be imposed as a matter of course. And this can be achieved, as already Andres and Bernardo said, through the intervention of central authorities and the Hague Network of Judges, both of which can have an important role in assisting the courts when a grave risk defense is raised. Courts, however, must avoid asking central authorities to undertake inquiries or investigations beyond their functions and powers. Something that sometimes has happened in the past in Argentina. Carolina, you may recall a case we had with England where the court requested so many undertakings that in the end, it was almost impossible to enforce in this decision. Anyway, in Argentina, I would say that the problem is not obtaining cooperation from the Central Authority or from the Hague Network Judge, who have long been in place and work together very efficiently to respond to requests made by courts to provide assistance regarding the availability of measures to protect a child from grave risk. The challenge we face in Argentina has more to do with the length of Hague proceedings, much as Alfonso has pointed out regarding the proceedings in Mexico. Cases take a long time to be decided, and we haven't legislated yet on a procedural law like Uruguay to regulate return proceedings. Many projects have been sent to Congress over the years for this purpose, but they have all lost a legislative status. The last of them in past February 2021, which is really very disappointed because this particular project had already been passed in one of the chambers and would have probably been approved if in February Congress had dealt with it. So in the meantime, what do we do? Our Supreme Court, working alongside the Permanent Bureau's Regional Office for Latin America, which is set in Buenos Aires, developed, as you said, Caro, a protocol in the year 2017, which dictates how return proceedings should be handled in order to comply with the obligations set forth both in The Hague and in the Inter-American Convention, which is Argentina is also party to. This protocol has had a positive impact on shortening the duration of proceedings, even though it is soft law and therefore not enforceable. But it has provided a set of rules for judges faced with a Hague Convention case, mostly guidelines on procedural matters, and it stresses the importance of conducting return proceedings expeditiously. We know that delays have truly a tremendous impact on children's lives, and the longer it takes for courts to decide on the return of a child, the harder it will be for the child and the more chances that an Article 13B exception may prosper. So time really is of the essence, and states need to review their own practices, not only with regards to interpretation of Article 13B, but also with regards to their procedural legislation to ensure prompt returns if the purpose of the convention is really to be met and fully satisfied. So thank you, Carolina, that is all.
Yeah, thank you. You've been very, all of you, very obedient with time. Thank you so much. We still have 2 minutes. We have a few questions, but we will not have time to deal with all of them. I'm going to be very brief, just 2 of them. One about Colombia, Andres. People understand that the psychological assessment is done by the local authority in all cases, or only when the defense Article 13B is presented, how or when the child's objection defense is presented. Can you tell us? Because people were surprised that the psychological assessment.
The first thing is that the yes, it is. It's surprising, and the as I told you, the first instance is the central authority request of evidence. So the first meeting that the kid has will be with the professional, the psychological professionals from the central authority, from the ICBF. So this determines what they are going to present to the judge. And as I told you, since the process here is this short, it's only 6 months, and there's going to be only one hearing, the judge has the possibility to order or not more evidence. And in most of the cases, the judge goes with what the ICBF or the central authority presents to him as an evidence. So a technical diagnosis or a technical statement from the psychologist from the ICBF in most of the cases is going to be determined on the ruling of the judge.
Brilliant. Thank you, Andres. And something that is going to be is part of the case that Jonathan was talking to us that has reached the Supreme Court in the United States. How do you deal with the... In many cases, the court who wants to send the children back to your country, they might ask for any criminal proceedings ongoing in your country to stay or to be suspended. Is this enforceable in your country? So we have a return from Alfonso, let's say England to Mexico, and in Mexico there are criminal proceedings ongoing for child adoption. If the English order say that those proceedings need to be suspended, will that be enforced by the Mexican courts? is quite, we are talking about criminal and civil proceedings and the conflict between and in the interplay with the two of them. What we normally do in England, we ask for evidence that the left behind parent has gone to the police authorities and has indicated that he doesn't wish or she doesn't wish to prosecute the other parent for the actions. Alfonso, you want to tell us, Mexico?
Right, same thing as in England. Usually what the parties do is they reach an agreement and both of them agree that they're not going to be pursuing and they grant a waiver. None of them are going to be pursuing any additional action against each other, which would include criminal proceedings. But they would have to reach an agreement in that regard and show that they have dropped any claims that they have brought before the Mexican authorities in that regard. But enforceable? No, it's not. I don't think it's enforceable. Yeah. They would have to drop it. They would have to drop their claims and show that they have been dropped by the authorities, that the dropping of the case and dismissal has been granted by the Mexican authorities. Otherwise, it wouldn't work.
Thank you, Alfonso. What about Jonathan? How will be treated in United States?
Well, I think the important distinction there is that that was one of the ameliorative measures of the undertaking. So those are promises or considerations made by the parties with regard to the return. It's not necessarily the court's ordering it per se. I mean, the court, my understanding, again, that, you know, I could be wrong, but it would appear that the court said some of these things need to take place for the return to happen. So you're kind of in a gray area. I mean, I've had instances where we're returning a child and it's kind of the same thing. We want, you know, clean slate, you go back, start a custody action, drop any kind of criminal charges you have against the person so that everybody is appearing equally. Nobody's kind of at a disadvantage. And it's often the case too that we may, in the cases where I'm defending, we may reach an agreement before the court issues an order so that there isn't an order for return, right? The order just says, we've agreed that the child will go back. That way the party, the left behind parent doesn't have the ability to use it as kind of a sword and a shield in any kind of custody case pending in the habitual residence. But that's kind of the crux of the undertakings and the ameliorative measures is that they're not per se enforceable. They're the parties making considerations to have the return done.
Yeah, and really sorry, we don't have time to deal with all of this. We have a few more questions. I will pass this to you by email and then you can answer them and we can send them to those attending today. So massive thanks from the International Academy of Family Lawyers, from Najudefa, from myself. It's been really interesting to have this exchange with you these days, preparing the panel. It's a fascinating topic, something that is changing day by day. Like Alfonso has said, now we have the COVID as Article 13B, but the good practice is giving us some orientation. So massive thanks. Have a lovely weekend, everyone. And we have now 15 minutes break and we are go back in 15 minutes to listen from Daniela that will be chairing the next panel. Thank you. Thank you so much.